From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some of you know the work of the filmmaker Godfrey Reggio. His 1982 film, Koyaanisqatsi, the first in a trilogy, was seen as creating a new cinematic form. The films have no clear plot or story or words. They're made up of images. I guess broadly you could say they're about technology, but some will see them as a condemnation, others more a celebration. Reggio says that's up to you. The idea isn't to get you to think about it, but to feel it. His films, he says, aren't aimed at the mind, but the gut. Today in the program, Godfrey Reggio is joining us. After 10 years, he has a new film called Visitors. We're screening it next week, talking about it today, and about Reggio's mission to get cinema to speak to the heart. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on documentary film. We're talking with Godfrey Reggio today. And here's a quick description of his remarkable life so far. He started out as a monk, became a monk activist and a teacher working with street gangs. And somehow over time, he became a filmmaker who's created this new form of cinema. And you've probably seen one or all of his Katsi trilogy. These were films that have no plot line or words. They are images, mesmerizing images of faces and traffic and buildings and fire and nature. It's a form he came to because he says our language is failing us. Reggio is taking that saying, pictures are worth 1,000 words, and he's flipping it. 1,000 images, he says, can give you the power of one word. The word you come up with is up to you. Reggio has a new film. It's called Visitors. That's the film we're screening next week. He's going to be here, in fact, for that screening, for a Q&A, and we'll give you a detail about that as we go along. Godfrey Reggio is joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Godfrey Reggio, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I want to begin. Let's start at sort of the beginning. Your early life spent in New Orleans, where you've said you lived a very fast life. What did you mean by that, your fast life in these early days?
Well, New Orleans is a city that could best be described as La Dolce Vita. Please, I love the city. My family has been there since the 1740s, so I'm an old-timer.
Right.
And in fact, most of my family is still there. As a young person, I was living a very fast life. I know that sounds strange because I decided to leave home at 13 and actually left home at 14.
Yeah.
And little did I know what I was getting into. Like most people, I tried to do the right thing, but of course for the wrong reason. It didn't matter what the reason was. Most important is what I did. So I left that very fast life in New Orleans and entered, as it were, the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
It was at once shocking and beyond anything I could have imagined. But let me say this, that it was a beautiful experience for me and mm-hmm. something that I will never regret that I did.
You know, you've told this the story about this moment when you took your final vows. I mean, you stayed there. You went in to become a monk at 14, and you stayed there for 14 years, and you had this decision to make. You're 25 years old to take your final vows, and I guess this would be the sort of the point of no return or something like that. And you decided to go for it. I mean, you were committed. I guess you in your mind you were going to do this for forever, live this life forever.
Well, I was committed. Not so much with grace and gratuity, but like to an insane asylum. And I mean that in a beautiful way, actually.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure for me to be able to take final vows. I became a lifer, as it were. But the work that I was doing was a pain in the side of my superiors. I was a Christian brother.
Yeah.
That's for those of you that don't know who the Christian Brothers are. They were founded in 1681 by John Baptist de La Salle. to make it as clear as I can, I was like a male nun. If I use a military metaphor, the bishops, the Jesuits, the Dominicans, all of those very important members of the church are like the field marshals, etc. I was like a foot soldier, like a field hippie in old terms.
Right.
And so it was a, you know, a great opportunity for me. But all brothers take not only the vows of poverty, chastity, obedience. Each order has its own particular vows. And in my order, we all took a vow to teach the poor gratuitously. Mm. Since the order was founded in 1681, like most things that are old, they tend to get bureaucratized, ossified, as it were. And this, the spirit of the law had, or the spirit of the vow had disappeared, and only the letter of the law was there because of the rationalization. If we teach the poor, how will we take care of ourselves? So being a young, zealous monk, that made no difference to me. As it were, my Che Guevara was a man called Giovanni Roncalli, or John the 23rd, a pope. And he said, accept nothing, question everything, even the structure of the church. So that was marching orders for me.
Yeah.
I was in a pontifical order under the pope. When the pope says that, that gave me, as it were, the authorization to drive my superiors crazy, to let me work with an element in the community of northern New Mexico where I lived, where fully 40% of the population was poor, had no access to primary medical care, and many of the youth were involved in gangs at that time. Gangs, I might add parenthetically, that are radically different from the gangs of this day. That, in effect, led my superiors when I was 28 to ask me to leave the order, that it was just too much. It was a disturbance.
You know, one thing that is interesting, I've heard you talk about what it was like living there, you know, living, as you say, in the Middle Ages. And I gather that it was all about routine. And I've heard you talk about routine, which I find interesting when we start coming a little bit later to your films. But this, you've talked about how this routine is kind of the, gives you this highest order of attention, this ability to be able to focus, which seems important to the films that you're going to make later, this idea of being aware. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that part, the how this routine, how living in this other time gave you a sense of a focus, and it helped your imagination in some way, it seems.
Well, let me give a little context to that. Yes, routine was very much part of the way that I lived, but let me back up a little bit. I was in Albuquerque in the early 90s. The Dalai Lama was giving a talk at the University of New Mexico. There were many people in the audience packed. At the end of his talk, he said he would entertain questions. A young woman stood up in the first row. She said, Your Holiness, what is the single most important thing that I can pay attention to? And almost without any thought, he said, Routine, next question. This was profound for me. Let me give you another example. Karl Marx asks, I'll try to rephrase his question. He says, Is it the content of your mind that determines your behavior? Or is it your behavior that determines the content of your mind? And for 9 out of 8 of us, of course, it's the behavior that we do that determines the content of our mind. Most of us feel that our intellect is our most important virtue.
Right.
But what we do every day without question, what we do for the sake of our, the assumptions, as it were, we make for the sake of our behavior determines what's in our mind. Mm. So for me, ordinary daily living, that which is most present but unseen by virtue of its presence, so that which is most normal, most familiar, most ordinary, is that which we see least of because of its presence. It's like the forest for the tree. Mm. We can't see the forest because the tree is too close in front of us. All of us, or for me, as it were, in ordinary daily living, on speed in rush hour, outrunning our future. And it is that I wanted to question in these films in a way that was as it were, a non-spoken narrative through the power of poetic cinema. I also learned as a child about ordinary daily living in quite a shocking way. As I said, I'm from New Orleans, but I got to witness the presence of evil in a very ordinary way. I saw it in my family. I saw it in my church. I saw it in the civic society I lived in, among my friends. It was as ordinary as the air I breathe, and I'm talking about racism. And it was shocking to me, especially as I heard it from my family, people I love dearly. It was not so much in their minds, it was more in their solar plexus. They were like marinated in this, as it were, intense evil, and that made a big impression on me. So the films that I try to do now, as most people, we live like parasites off of our childhood. And my childhood taught me a lot about the remarkably unordinariness of ordinary daily living.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make that the focus of the projects that I do.
You've been thinking about technology for a long time. I mean, this has come to a lot of us lately in the digital era, you know, technology, the ubiquity of all of that, and, you know, this NSA question and the question of privacy. But back in the 70s, this was after Watergate, you created this multimedia campaign about the use of technology that's being used to control behavior and to invade people's privacy. So this is something you've been thinking about for decades.
Well, I don't know if I've been thinking about it. It's been thinking about me.
Right.
I'll give you a little example. When I was in New Orleans as a child, I went to a school called Mata Dolorosa, Mother of Sorrows. If I forget about her, she remembers me. Well, it's the same thing with technology. In 1973 and 1974, in the collective I'm part of, the Institute for Regional Education, we decided to do a multimedia saturation campaign on the use of technology to invade privacy and control behavior. Everything we see in the newspapers, that project was called, by the way, 10 More Years and Counting. It was released in 74, and we were alluding to Orwell's 1984, which seems like now 1,000 years ago. Everything we hear now about the NSA, that Snowden is helping to release, et cetera, all of those things were hidden in plain sight then and before, if anyone wanted to look at it. It was in an analog mode, not a digital mode at that moment. But technology was used, for example, in what's called the law enforcement the LEAA, the Law Enforcement, I can't remember, administration. And what it did was take police departments all over the United States and infiltrate them with all the latest new weaponry technology that was coming out of Vietnam. Same thing with moon technology that got us to the moon was then infiltrating the entire society we lived in. So it was present way back then, and now we're becoming very aware of it. Our privacy to live in this world is not to have privacy. While we might be very disturbed about what the NSA is doing, so many people use Facebook and all kinds of other electronic gizmos and gadgets. In using those people that provide us with that service are analyzing us so that we can be, as it were, caught up by the, or eaten up more properly by those that wish to sell us something. Mm. So all of us have profiles that are too numerous even to indicate by virtue of being involved in a technological world.
Yeah. You had said technology isn't something we use, it's something we live.
Yes, it's like as ubiquitous as the air we breathe. We keep thinking that technology is neutral. It's the use or misuse that one makes of it that determines its value. To me, this is fallacious. It's not real. Technology has politics, has a point of view. It's not the effect of technology on the environment, on the economy, on religion, on culture, on war, etc. It's that everything now is situated in technology. I know that's kind of a tongue twister, and it's hard to understand. It took a time for me to try to understand it. What I'm leading to is that technology is the new and comprehensive host of life. Mm. Now, please, I'm only saying that. I can't insist that this is the truth. I'm giving it to you as my point of view.
Yeah.
But if technology is the new and comprehensive host of life, as I said, as present as the air that we breathe, then it becomes something that is almost inescapable. Anything we could have said about the divines in the past, we can say about technology now. It is remaking the world to its own image and likeness. It also has an infinite appetite that operates in a very finite world. Being sensate creatures, being creatures that become what we see, smell, touch, hear, taste, we become the environment we live in. We are becoming technology. In that sense, I can say, at least from my point of view, that we are now cyborgs, not of the science fiction, but of the fiction of science. We have within our bodies over 100 trace elements that didn't even exist on the planet 100 or so years ago. We are becoming the technology that we think we use.
Godfrey Reggio is with us. His newest documentary film is called Visitors. We're screening it next Wednesday. That's February 19th. It's going to be at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens film series and our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Godfrey Reggio is going to join us there on Wednesday, so you should come. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the work of Godfrey Reggio. Some of you know of his work. He's a former monk who created this whole new style of cinema. The films have no clear plot or story, really, but they're made up of these powerful and beautiful and sometimes frightening images that explore our relationship with technology. His new film is called Visitors, which we're screening next week as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Godfrey Reggio will join us next Wednesday. Today, he's joining us from New York to talk about his work. And Godfrey Reggio, I wanted to ask you about, so really, you, I'm not sure if getting kicked out is the right way to put it, but they sort of asked you, maybe this is, the, I guess the monks there said, Godfrey, this is maybe not for you. And at some point, you saw, I mean, the. I think it's interesting to sort of make that leap to then you becoming this filmmaker. And somewhere along the line, you saw a film, Luis Buñuel's Los Olvidados, which you've described as kind of being this spiritual experience. And that seems to have really inspired you to decide maybe you should try films, that could be something for you. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Indeed. I was working in the barrios of northern New Mexico with street gangs, young men and women who were beautiful people. You know, if you tell a person, excuse my language, if they're a shit, they'll be that. If you tell them they're beautiful, most of us will arise to that occasion. I was out there telling them how beautiful they were. Mm-hmm. During the course of that time, another brother from Santa Fe said, please, I'm going to show you something that if you see might change your life. Now, I must add that as a brother, we didn't see many movies. Maybe we saw The Life of Christ or Monsieur Vincent or The Little Flower of Jesus. Nothing more than that. No Hollywood films at that point. Now that's all changed, but that was like 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And when I saw Buñuel's film, Los Olvidados, The Young and the Damned, The Forgotten Ones, it was like a spiritual experience for me. It moved me deeply. It didn't inform me, it affected me, and affected many of the young men and women I was working with. It became like, in quotes, a church for us. And I felt, as you well said, that if that could be so moving as a medium, knowing that people are attracted into the visual medium as almost a way of living now, that that would be something I would love to explore. And that led me ultimately into making, doing this ACLU campaign on technology that we talked about a while ago, and invasion of privacy, and from that into Koyaanisqatsi.
Yeah. Koyaanisqatsi is, it's interesting, that film, because this idea of language, you've talked about how language, our language, has sort of lost its ability to describe the world in which we live. That's one of the reasons why you decided to create films that were nonverbal. I wanted you to talk about that. What do you mean? Our capacity for language is failing us, I guess, now.
Well, again, this is a point of view, and please, I'm inflicting you and your audience with it, but let me go forward. I do feel that our language no longer describes the world in which we live. To me, that is an enormous tragedy. It is describing a world that is no longer here. When I was talking about technology and how misunderstood it is, let me give you a little quote from Einstein. He says, "The fish will be the last to know water. We will be the last to know the world that we're living in because we're so surrounded by it." So we're surrounded in a brand new world that's, as it were, we're living in, but invisible by virtue of its presence. And our language is not describing that world. So as you said earlier, I wanted to make a film using that Napoleonic dictum that a picture's worth 1,000 words, I wanted to make a picture, as it were, with many images that would give you the power of one word. In this case, the word being Koyaanisqatsi. Mm. And of course, Koyaanisqatsi means life out of balance, life in turmoil, life disintegrating, crazy life, and most importantly, a way of life that calls for another way of living. Mm. So it's not for lack of love of the language. My main interest and love, in fact, in life is language, because we see the world through the languages that we speak. If our languages are not describing that world, it's beyond tragic. In that sense, we see the world through language. I have to conclude, therefore, that not only the blind cannot see, not only the deaf cannot hear. I felt that all of us are becoming an aura blind, literally, to the world we live in. And I felt that if I could make a cinema that, at least in a very small way, because it's not a mass man form, it's not available to everyone, one would have to be willing to leave their familiar, their normal, leave their expectations at the door, as it were. If I could make a cinema that could, in effect, through visualization, give people the power of language in a different form, then I feel that life would have been enough for me.
You know, I want to ask you about the first image we see in Koyaanisqatsi. It's from the Great Gallery pictogram in Horseshoe Canyon here in Utah, in Canyonlands National Park. Did you always know that that would be the it's the first and the last image, in fact, that we see?
Well, I'm very moved, like many people, by pictograms. I think they have a message from the past that is relevant now. It's not so much understanding it as feeling it. And I felt very attracted to that whole Four Corners area of Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona. In fact, a good bit of the film was shot in that whole beautiful area of the United States. And those images were very moving to me. I want to say this, that if you put a frame around something, if you put bookends on something, then our natural inclination is to conjure meaning. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to start the film in the same way that I ended the film. It gives it a context. It gives it the assumption of a meaning. Not only is there those beautiful images that are certainly mystical and mysterious of figures floating in different relations of gravity, so it looks like they're floating in the air, but also the liftoff of our fantastic rocket program, yeah, missile program, leading us up into space. And at the end, those same shots, and of course, the capsule explodes and comes back down to Earth. So these are visual ways of trying to say more than I could possibly speak, because I feel these films have more to say than I can certainly tell people. If it touches them, then maybe it starts a dialogue within the person themselves. So it's like becomes like a speechless narrative.
Yeah, I want to sort of underscore that, because I have to be careful about framing this film, Visitors, or any of your work really, as having an agenda or a message. Because I've read where you don't like the idea of these films being perceived as propaganda, even as you say for the right cause, that it's you're about the experience, not about some discrete sort of agenda or message.
Right. The films that I do, because they are hard to put into a category, let's say, I look at them more like a cine monad, if I can be so bold. Let me try to explain. The form that I use to make these films is a form that I call the autodidactic form. And if you know what didactic is, I don't wish to be overtly didactic. Let me tell you why. I know how fragile all of us are. We're enormously influenced by image. In fact, images are used to propagate ideological, religious, etc. point of views to control people. In the 1930s, for example, the U.S. Congress had to decide whether they would give First Amendment rights to documentary films. Now, in 2014, that might sound ridiculous. We might laugh. But just look at it. In the 1930s, everywhere from Russia to the United States to all over Europe and Japan, cinema was being used to control people's mentalities, to make monsters out of their enemies. I experienced that as a very, very young child in New Orleans during the Second World War. I didn't call Japanese people Japanese. They were Japs. They were the enemy. It was influencing the way I felt. And looking back on that, I can understand quite well why the U.S. Congress would consider whether to give First Amendment rights, because images can be at once not only propaganda, but advertising. We live in a world where we see more images in a few days than a person in the Middle Ages would see in their entire life. Mm. And those images influence us. We become what we see. So I wanted to develop a form without language that would give you the possibility, as now I said, for an autodidactic experience. And what I mean by that is that whoever sees these films, he becomes the storyteller, the character, and the plot of the film. They're made to evoke those triplets, the aesthetic triplets that exist within all of us, of sensation, emotion, and perception. In that sense, it's a free gift. And knowing that, and I'm sure your audience knows this, if you show a picture to someone, we all see a different picture. Unless, of course, you're looking at a Coca-Cola sign or some advert, which is, pounding it into your head, telling you that this will give you happiness or joy or whatever other nonsense they're trying to tell us. But as regards art, if we all looked at the Mona Lisa and got the same point of view, it would be kind of boring. The beauty of the Mona Lisa is its mystery. the beauty of art is its mystery, that it's up to the beholder, herself, himself, to have a response to it. So I'm trying to make a film, I'm trying to make films, as it were, that are like artopsies, that allow us to see with our own eyes that which is present in front of us.
Such an important part of the films are the music, then the music of Philip Glass. I wanted to have you talk about the first time you approached Philip Glass. This was when you were putting together Koyaanisqatsi, and he said no. I don't do movie music. He turned you down the first time.
He did. I mean, he was had just done Einstein on the Beach. Yeah. And went back to driving a taxi cab. He was an avant-garde superstar at that point, famous in New York, and film was not of interest to him. But I had two friends that knew him, and after having listened to as many contemporary composers as my ears would allow, upon hearing Philip Glass's music, I said, this is the person. His music, for me, did not illustrate. It was a moving experience. It was always ascending and never arriving. And most important, it had always two elements operating at the same time simultaneously, and that is the foreground and background of his music. To me, it was quintessential cinematic music. To make a long story short, through his two friends who were my friends, they got him to agree to come see a screening that I set up in New York at the Anthology Film Archives, Jonas Mekas's beautiful facility. And I showed him pictures actually from the American Southwest, from the Four Corners, from Utah and Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, that are in the beginning of Koyaanisqatsi. And I played two kinds of music. I played the remarkable piece of Mussorgsky's reinterpreted Pictures at an Exhibition by Tomita, an electronic genius from Tokyo. Beautiful, beautiful piece of music. And then I played a piece of Philip Glass's music called North Star. And then I said, as you can see, Philip, yours works better. And of course, he couldn't disagree.
Right.
And he fully intended to stay for a while and duck out, and that would be the end of it. But when he saw the fusion of his music with these images, I think he also saw what I saw, that they're like dancing partners. Let me look at it this way. We have a bilateral body.
Yeah.
The films are a corpus, a body. I can't think of doing a film without thinking of Philip Glass.
Yeah.
He is my bilateral partner. Without him, I'm only half present, and that would look pretty ridiculous. So he and I are not, let's say we're youngsters because we can't observe ourselves,
yeah.
But we're in our mid-70s and moving forward. And we feel we're just beginning to understand the collaboration that we've been involved in for over 30-something years. So it's a great pleasure to work with him. He's a musical genius. And more than that, he's a person that's willing to operate in a critical forum. People of his capacity now and fame are usually surrounded by people who tell them what they want to hear. Philip, to the contrary, wants to be told what I actually feel, what my collaborators actually feel. So it's a critical forum. And in doing that, it allows him to bring forth his best music. I'm sure, as most of your audience knows, composers today, when they do cinema, write what are called music cues. Those cues are anywhere from a few seconds to as long as a minute or so. I'm asking Philip Glass, in the case of Visitors, to write an 87-minute, 33-second symphony.
Yeah.
It's a completely different dynamic. It's like one medium motivating the other. Philip Glass's music is the emotive narrative, as it were, for the film.
You know, there's this terrific little short documentary that is a DVD extra for Koyaanisqatsi, and I picked a clip here from Philip Glass talking about your relationship. This in particular is about Koyaanisqatsi, but I think it's reflective of probably all of your work. And there's this kind of insight that he came to as you're working early on in this process, where he had, as you'll hear in this clip, where he talks about how he had divided it into sections, and then you reassembled it. And he came to this kind of idea that you were about the ambience, not about the structure of the music. Here's a clip. This is Philip Glass.
When he first gave me a cut of it, I divided the cut into sections, and I timed the sections. There were about 12 or 13 or 14, or maybe more, different moments. And then I wrote music for each section, and I put it together. Then Godfrey listened to that music, and he completely reassembled the images. So it didn't fit at all the way I thought it was going to. So basically, I tried to put them together, and he pushed them apart in a certain way. And I think he was right to. What he did, in effect, was he took the ambience of the music instead of the structure of the music. And he cut to the ambience and not to the structure. So he cut to the feeling of the music and not the way the music was built, which turned out to be the right way to do it.
It's interesting. He also talks about what he calls this idea of observing the distance between the music and the image. And he talks about how in a commercial, the sound and the music are sort of on top of each other. But what was important for him, and I guess it was important for you, is that you give people a space, room, for us, for the observers, to get in between that space there in terms of the music and the imagery. I thought that was a really interesting way of putting it.
It's not only interesting, it's essential for this kind of cinema. Let me say again what you know, that when we use language, it proceeds through metaphor, the known introducing the unknown. When we use music, it bypasses metaphor. Music portends a direct communion to the soul of the listener. That's why music has often been a problem for authorities like governments and churches, because it can't be controlled. It touches people uniquely and differently for each person. So Philip Glass's music becomes the emotive, in that sense, the emotive narrative, and speaks uniquely and differently to each person that can hear it. Like, the films we do certainly are not to entertain you. They're not logical. They're not linear. They're not to give you information. They are, in effect, to affect you. They are to, this might sound too strong, but to inflict you with something, to watermark you. Mm-hmm. And music has that enormous capacity to do so.
Godfrey Reggio is with us. His new documentary film is called Visitors. We're screening it next Wednesday. That's February 19th. It's at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Godfrey Reggio is going to join us on Wednesday. We hope you will, too. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the filmmaker Godfrey Reggio. We're talking about his newest film, Visitors, which we're screening next week, next Wednesday, at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. You can get details on our website, and we'll talk a little bit more about it as we go along. Godfrey Reggio is going to join us, by the way, in Salt Lake. I wanted to ask you about, so you had this upbringing we talked about that was remarkable. You were set in contemporary America, of course, but you were living as if you were in the Middle Ages, as you said. And I wonder if that had any influence in some way on this new film, the sense of being in another time, reflecting on the disconnection now of the digital era.
It certainly did. I guess I learned as a young monk that the stiller a person is, the calmer a person is, the more heightened their senses. Contemporary image making, if you go to a feature film, which all of us do, Those films, their cuts are happening every 3 to 6 seconds. So they're literally thousands of images that are coming at you. If you come see visitors, it could be more like a deprogramming experience. There's 74 images in 87 minutes. That's roughly an average of 70 seconds an image. When images are coming at you so fast, of course, you don't absorb those images in the same way. What you're being told by the images is a story that the director and the screenplay want you to have. When you're, as it were, allowed to stare at an image, something also I learned as a young brother, I learned when I was a novice that if I wanted for the first time to see my familiar, my ordinary, my normal, I must stare at it until it looks strange. To have an image up on the screen that long allows us to see it perhaps in a way that if it was coming quickly, we would not see. So those are things I've carried through from being a Christian brother. They certainly influence me. I am, as it were, watermarked by those experiences, and I try to carry them into the work that I do. I don't try to carry them in. I do. They carry me into the work. Yeah. What it ends up with is a cinema that is the odd one out most of the time. Now, remarkably, because of Cinedigm, it's the odd one in. So it's counterintuitive to the way we see images, and will be demanding. I try to tell the audience, if they come to these films, that please make every effort to leave your expectations at the door.
That's true.
If you're coming and looking for the meaning of the film, you'll miss the whole event. Be more like a traveler. You live in beautiful Utah. It is one of the most phenomenal pieces of land on this planet and probably any other. One would not go to Canyonlands and say, gee whiz, I wonder what Canyonlands means. That would be stupid. I mean, if you're studying it as a geologist, maybe there's a place for that. Of course there is. But as a person going out in nature, letting nature speak to you, it's more to let those images absorb you, to let them speak to you. So while you're not asking what they mean, definitely they can be a meaningful experience. And that's what I'm trying to offer in this film. Now, of course, these are extra mental activities. It's like watching the sunset with your sweetheart. If you ask her, what is the meaning of the sunset today, darling? She might say, well, you know, that's kind of a stupid question, John. It's whether the sunset is moving to you. So these films are based in that. Yeah. They're trying to move the audience, trying to give us an opportunity, as it were, to contemplate, to be slow, to look at, to view, to observe, to meditate, to gaze. It's a story to behold. And parenthetically, we're all contemplative now. We're all addicted to screens. Mm-hmm. I'm an observer of people. A screen is that which separates one thing from another. But we are attracted into the screens that we have. And in that sense, we're all involved in technological contemplation. It's so present, it's unescapable, as it were.
You know, the first image in Koyaanisqatsi is the pictograph we talked about. The first image in this film is a gorilla. A lowland gorilla, and it's remarkable. I don't want to say too much about the film because I want people to experience it fresh, but did you always know that would be the first image?
Yes, I did. The gorilla, 2.5 primates in the pew, black and white, slow, those were all things basically from the beginning when the film got some form. Let me talk about the gorilla a minute. Lauren Isley, a poet, an anthropologist, a philosopher, a brilliant man, made this beautiful comment. I'll try to paraphrase it. He says, if we wish to see ourselves as human beings for the first time, we must be seen through the eyes of another animal. And I felt, of all the primates, we are a primate, of all the primates, the primate that we share a visage most closely with in terms of our face is the female, Western lowland female gorilla, of which Trishka is a beautiful example. Yeah. Now, had we looked at Trishka in Africa, had we filmed Trishka in the Bronx Zoo, where they spent $30 million to make it look like Africa, then we would be looking at a gorilla. But when you take the background out of the gorilla and put her in the background, then it changes the whole dynamic of relationships. Trishka now is looking at you, and that sets up what I call a dialogic relationship of one person to the other.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that's compelling also is that we see these faces, these human faces as well in the film. Who are they looking at? Godfrey Reggio, who are they looking at in that film?
Well, the first set of images we see are from what I call the inside out. There, the people were asked to do nothing more than sit and pose for a portrait. They weren't asked to think about anything. They weren't asked not to blink. They were only asked, please, to sit and let us, with a very slow dolly, inhumanly slow, almost imperceptibly slow, moving gently closer and closer and closer to their face. Most of the images, however, of faces in the film are either children watching television or young adults gaming or people in a sports bar watching the Final Four basketball game in 2011. These are images from the outside in. The predicate in the room, as it were, not seen, is the screen. As soon as, while all of these people knew they were being filmed, as soon as the TV came on, the game came on, etc., they were like, it was like a tractor beam pulling them right out of themselves, right into that screen, because the direction of this for the people that were in the film, all these extras, second unit people basically, was non-self-conscious behavior. Mm-hmm. I asked them to do only what they normally do. We all watch TV. We all, many young people play games. We all watch, you know, sports, etc. So it was to capture that. And while they were knew they were being filmed, again, as soon as that TV comes on, again, like a tractor beam pulls a person right out of themselves. So what you see is not acted. It is the real presence of how we look when we're engaged with these mediums.
Mm-hmm. How important is it to you that people gather to see this experience of being together in a theater? I think you called it a social solitary event, which I really liked.
Well, being in a cinema, unlike watching something on your hand gadget, which is, let's say, a very reduced emotive experience, being in a cinema where the lights go down, it's similar to being around a campfire, which is part of who we are as human beings. We want a story. But it's also one of the few places now where we are together socially in silence. And while we're not speaking to each other, there is a presence of other that influences us in a way that there's too little time now to talk about. But it's one of the unique experiences we still have. And of course, that will disappear as well, as all of these mediums are becoming so present that the cinemas look like they're basically disappearing. Mm.
You've said that some of the people find the film kind of confrontational. What is the reaction you're getting so far?
Well, for some people, the reaction is it's like going to a hamburger stand, getting a beautiful bun with all the dressing, but where's the meat? So they're looking for the meaning of the film, and as I said earlier, they're going to miss the whole thing. For other people, it could be incredibly boring because there's not the clarity of a story to be told. Rather, there's a story to behold. For some, it can be, and at least in the few people I've talked to, a moving or a spiritual experience. For others, it feels confrontational because here you have someone looking directly at you. Now, as you probably know in cinema, one of the cardinal rules not to break is to have the actors look directly into the lens of the camera. There are exceptions to that, but that's the general rule. Why? Because it breaks the voyeuristic relationship of we, the audience, looking through the keyhole, as it were, at everything from intimacy to murder to et cetera, et cetera. So here we're breaking that rule. We're not telling you what to think. We are having someone look you directly into the eye, and for some, it'll make us very, very uncomfortable. Mm.
Let me ask you this finally. It's probably too big a question to ask with a minute left, but there's this invisible truth that you've talked about that tells us sort of who we are and this, as you've put it, the reckless path that we're on. And I wonder if you think at this point, Godfrey Reggio, if we can correct that course, that in some way we are in control, or is this, do you think, some natural system that's playing out that we can maybe sort of play around with, manipulate at the edges, but in the end we can't really change it. We can't really stop it.
Well, if you look at it as the global world in which we live, then it's impossible. It's beyond any one person's ability to change the world. In fact, I think it's megalomania to think about that. But if your audience sees the world as their range of relationships, as what they can do in their own situation, then the world is capable of being changed. There's nothing more powerful than example. An example happens in a very concrete way. All of us have the ability not to live in this rooted future of the globalized world, for which, for me, is a hopeless journey. We have the possibility to live in an uncreated future, a world of our own creation, and that's why we're here.
Godfrey Reggio. His newest film, it's called Visitors, and you can see it next Wednesday, February 19th. It's at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Godfrey Reggio is going to join us, and you can get details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Godfrey Reggio, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.